From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, a child and family therapist shares insight on how to support young people facing mental health crises. Then we learn about Black Space, a place dedicated to therapy for Black, Brown, and LGBTQ people.
People would say that Black and Brown people do not want to go to therapy and they are not interested. Absolutely they are. It's a myth. When you supply a safe space, they will come.
Plus, we'll look at the history of the Lake Geneva Playboy Club and the stigma of working there as a bunny.
They would say that they feel stigmatized still to this day. You know, people would ask me when I tell them that I was working on a book about the Playboy Resort, they'd say, well, weren't they prostitutes or exotic dancers? And my experience was it wasn't that at all.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. Between April and October of 2020, emergency departments across the nation saw a rise in visits from children with mental health needs. The complete change of daily life and social isolation during the pandemic has had an impact on kids' mental health. A report from the Department of Education states that as schools begin to open, students will need more support to deal with the isolation, anxiety, and trauma they've been experiencing. Alicia Corbett is a child and family therapist at Children's Wisconsin, and she says there are warning signs to look out for and ways to help. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in April and begins by describing some of those risk factors.
So there are a number of risk factors for this age group. So if we look at drug and alcohol use, it is just like with adults, it lowers inhibitions. And so the decision making that you may have had prior to that would not be the same. When we look at bullying in schools where it is like a very repetitive thing and children or adolescents maybe don't see a way out of that sort of distress because at this point in their life, like friends and socialization are a huge part and that's like part of their development. So when they're faced with that sort of level of adversity continuously, it can make it very difficult for them to continue to function typically. There's always like potential for suicidal crisis that happens, and these situations can lead to that. But exposure to suicide from a family member, friend, somebody that they idolize is a risk factor, loss of relationship. So whether that person died or not, it's the loss of relationship that matters. So was there a significant breakup that they've just had? Has somebody who was very important in their life moved away? So it's really the loss of the relationship, not the death necessarily. Mental illness can be a risk factor when you're looking at especially mood disorders, just the basic impulsivity of this age group. The whole like frontal lobe is not fully there yet. And so when they're contemplating decisions, they're working on the information that they have, but the information that they have may not be perceived accurately as we look at things as adults. So time is very different for us. We've lived many more years. And so something that seems like insignificant in terms of time frame for us is a big deal when you haven't lived that many years. Issues related to acceptance of sexual orientation, usually by family caregiver who they are surrounded by, is definitely increases the risk for youth. And the biggest predictor is a prior suicide attempt. So if they have attempted suicide in the past by whatever means that they chose, that is the biggest predictor of whether that will happen again.
What you say about considering things from their point of view, that things are very pressing and their brain development doesn't see very much past, I think that's really important to bring up. And one other thing I'm wondering about is, does a young person necessarily need to have a diagnosis or a known history of mental illness when they start struggling with thoughts of suicide? Can this seemingly come out of nowhere?
They can have a mental illness diagnosed and they may not have one diagnosed, but it's really about the crisis. So do I see a way out of my situation that is causing this level of distress for me. So if people don't, in general, not even just youth, but people in general, if they don't see a way out of a very stressful, pressing, or distressing situation, it can definitely lead to some thoughts at times about maybe I shouldn't be here, or maybe I want to die, or things like that. So it just kind of depends on how far that thought process is taken for that individual.
So with your work during this time of the pandemic, where it created a forced isolation for children and a shift to a virtual world, they don't have that school escape during the day, the socialization factors, and whether they're equipped for it or not, depending on their home life, technology, accessibility, what have you heard are some of the main struggles kids have faced during this time?
I think it's important to look at both sides. So some kids have definitely struggled during this time, but some kids have definitely thrived during this time as well. So students who maybe were experiencing a lot of anxiety with going to school and being in class and the pressure of social situations and just that day-to-day piece of being in school, some of those children have really thrived during this point in terms of people that I see in practice. If students were super social, they were always out with their friends, they were involved in a lot of things at school or outside of school, that has been a far more difficult transition for the youth that I see in practice, because they're cut off from like their quote unquote regular life. And so that abrupt change definitely created some adjustment and transition situations that some were easily handled, whether it be the youth temperament or how their family is set up. And sometimes that was very difficult, that change, because this is like their whole life. This is what they were used to. The unknown was really a big thing that really came up in talking to my clients, that like, when is this going to end? When is this going to be over? When can I go back to school? When can I go back to my real life? When can I like play sports again?
What about online activity? You know, with school being largely virtual, do you have any other concerns for the amount of time kids are online or in their rooms on screens for school and for play?
I try to make sure that my clients are definitely taking advantage of being outside of their room, off of screens, and getting some outside time, which I know can be fairly uncomfortable in Wisconsin in the winter, but getting outside is very important because you're moving your body, you're in a different environment, you're getting sunlight. And so for some of my clients, we have very specific plans about this is how many times a week I want you to try to be outside and for like a half an hour. Because I had some clients that were not, I asked like, when was the last time you went outside? And they'd be like, oh, it was a couple weeks ago. Like, no, that's not, that is not healthy for you as just a human being, less than that in this time where things are just very atypical and very different from regular life.
And during the pandemic, obviously, all of us are struggling, adults included. So these two ends of kids and adults colliding, struggling together can cause, you know, a lot of difficulties at home when we're all spending so much time together. So how do you suggest parents can keep an eye on their kids and check in on their mental health while also demonstrating that it's okay to struggle, that they're struggling too, but let's create a safe environment?
I would definitely say opening up that conversation and having some routine that works for like their family, whether you're a family that eats dinner together or you eat lunch together because everybody's home now and people kind of are at their own for dinner because things are opening up a little more. There's some sports happening and things like that. But really creating a routine for your family where there is time to kind of spend together and have that kind of conversation and lay eyes on them. Because many parents are very in tune to what's happening with their children, even though sometimes the kids try to hide it. So having those opportunities to have really good communication and observation of them are very important.
What are some good, simple, and approachable questions you suggest parents can ask their kids or start with?
They can ask them, like, how are you feeling today? What has gone well today? What was difficult today? How are you doing in this virtual environment? What are you looking forward to? As you know, there are vaccines coming out and restrictions are loosening and students are returning back to school, which is giving them schedule and normalcy and things like that, just general conversation to have with them, which I know is sometimes like pulling teeth with adolescents because they're at an age where they, you know, want their privacy and no mom and dad or grandma, grandpa, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to do that. But having that time where it doesn't even have to be focused on anything specific, but just general conversation, whether it's interests, whether it is looking at planning to do, but having that communication and conversation with them, but also not staying like in closed door rooms. And that really kind of goes for everybody because it's already isolating during COVID. And that just, that's another barrier between you and another human.
What do you believe are some universal warning signs? I know each child is different, each teen is different, and each situation is different, but in general, what should caretakers and parents be looking out for in their kids and teens staying at home if they believe they're struggling?
There's a quick mnemonic device called FACT, and it's feelings, actions, changes, threats. So looking at any changes and significant changes, whether your child was doing fairly well in school and all of a sudden they're just bottoming out in grades, or whether they have had this history of maybe not doing as well and all of a sudden their grades like shoot up. Any sort of major changes are very important to look at. Any sort of feeling of extreme depression, sadness, anger, whether that be inward or outward, looking for more intense feelings. Are there any feelings of excessive guilt or hopelessness? Is the youth giving possessions away that are meaningful to them? Has there been any increased drug or alcohol use? Have they indirectly or directly threatened to kill themselves? Whether it's the, I just don't want to be here anymore, which is such a vague question, like you don't want to be in the house, you don't want to be in school, and really following up with that, or to the extent that like, I want to die, I want to kill myself, I don't want to be alive anymore. When youth start to search for means, the, I want to say number one way that they are looking at in terms of suicide reduction is means restriction. And that is not to go against anyone's right to own a firearm. It's just about keeping things in safe storage, whether it's a gun safe or a lock. And it can be hard to restrict some means, but going over that with either your healthcare provider or if the student is in therapy, things like that. But looking at very significant ways to be able to monitor that, locking up any sort of medications that are around, even if it's over the counter. And if there's any like writing of a suicide note, those are all definitely large warning signs. And looking at their outlook. So if your child has been like very sad, very down, not coming out of their room, and all of a sudden they're like very happy, super social, interacting with everyone, you're like, oh, this is great. You still want to check in about that change, because sometimes when people make decisions for themselves, it is like a big relief to know that like, I'm not going to have to feel this pain anymore. I'm not going to have to suffer anymore. And so that can create like this levity of emotion and outlook for them, which is sometimes, I think, overlooked.
Yeah, the positive swings, it's something I wouldn't have normally considered. Do you believe there's any other large misconceptions about child and teen suicide and mental health crises that parents and people don't understand or consider?
Many people think that if you ask whether it's a youth or an adult, like directly, are you thinking about killing yourself, that it's planting that idea? And it's not. Usually for that person, if they are feeling that way, it's a relief, because would be very difficult to come to someone, including like a parent or even somebody at school, to say like, I'm really thinking about dying and this is why. So asking that question very directly, although can be very difficult for people in any sort of way, it is very important to be able to ask the question, are you thinking about killing yourself, versus are you thinking about hurting yourself? Because if you see this as a way out, you're not going to look at this as hurting yourself. This is like a solution for what's going on.
Well, Alicia Corbett, I want to thank you for sharing your insights on this really important topic today.
You're welcome.
Alicia Corbett is a child and family therapist at Children's Wisconsin. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You can also find links to other resources at wuwm.com. There are many barriers that prevent Black and Brown people from accessing mental health services. Barriers like stigma that's attached to seeking help, lack of transportation, affordability, and the lack of Black and Brown therapists in the field. But the three founders of Black Space in Milwaukee are hoping to change that. They want to normalize therapy for Black and Brown men, women, and LGBTQ people with free group therapy experiences. For the last year, Darius Smith, Corey Fells, and Dr. Leah Knox have offered sessions at No Studios in downtown Milwaukee. The space was Smith's idea. He was active in last summer's social justice protests, which he says left him feeling overwhelmed and depressed. So he reached out to Fells and proposed offering free therapy for people who could relate. Fells connected with Dr. Knox, a counselor and behavioral health consultant, and Black Space became a reality. They all spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell in April. Smith says they've seen the largest turnout in Black and Brown men, and he starts by discussing some common themes he's noticed in these sessions.
I can definitely say with the men is communicating effectively and understanding not to overextend yourself as far as love. It's just, I think the biggest thing is what I've noticed is it's just a lot of the stuff that women complain to us that men are doing to them, or like the abusiveness as far as like, I don't know how to control my emotions. I'm here, I'm there. It's a lot of different things, just being able to communicate effectively and the thing with being heard. I think that's a lot of it is just more so of being heard and not being a burden to anybody. And I think is once we create that, keep doing this more and more, and we create that, you know, it's okay to talk about how you may feel. Men, you know, we'll start opening up more and understanding, like, you're not looked upon in any other way just for you expressing how you feel. So a lot of the times, you know, a lot of the men in this space is going like a tirade with just a ball of emotions of the things that they wish they was able to tell their partners, their friends, or whoever it may be. So it's never just one thing. It's like just life.
Some of the common themes that I've recognized and acknowledged in our men group are feeling overwhelmed, because it's a myth when they say Black men are lazy. Black men are so angry. Black men are out here having all these children. You know, all the myths and stereotypes of Black men and brown men absolutely are myths. Our Black men are wonderful fathers, and they want to be wonderful fathers, and they're striving to be wonderful fathers. However, a lot of them have the world on their shoulders. So that's one common theme, is I have the world on my shoulder. I was born and bred, and historically I'm here to be a provider as well. However, right now I can't really find a job, or I'm looking so hard. However, still not a myth, because of the color of my skin, because of how I may speak or where I am in this world, I'm not able to get the kind of job with the kind of pay that I need or want. And I also have a child, or maybe two, and I have a partner that I want to take care of, not I want them to take care of me. So with all of this, I have this on my shoulder, and I'm very critical of myself, because I'm critical of myself because I expect the best from me, and I don't feel like I'm doing my best. So it's causing me anxiety symptoms of, and it's causing me symptoms of depression. Like Darius said, communication. I'm trying to communicate these things to my partner, to my mom, to my friend. However, there's a stigma of communicating. I feel kind of less than because my expectation of myself are here. I feel like I'm meeting them there, but people around me think I'm doing just fine. So an overriding theme is I don't really know what to say or what to do, and I don't want to be seen as a punk. So that masculinity part, that's an overriding theme. So when the men do come, it's wonderful. And people would say that Black and brown people do not want to go to therapy and they are not interested. Absolutely, they are. It's a myth. However, when you supply a safe space, they will come. Mm-hmm. It's just how many safe spaces do we have here? I've heard of Black space.
And I would like to piggyback off of that. There's three variants and reason why Black and brown individuals, from women to LGBTQIA to men, are hesitant to therapy is because the accessibility as far as financial costs, accessibility to transportation, and also having someone that you feel like you don't have to speak in parables, or you don't have to talk with full of like nuances and educating cultural differences. Those are the three things we're looking to dismantle when it comes to approaching the sensitive topics, and also just the overall general theme of therapy when we're looking to connect with communities.
Thank you all for sharing that. I can see how some of those sessions could turn into tirades, because that is a lot for people to be dealing with. And I want to go back to what you said about creating a safe space for these folks to feel like they can say what they want to, what's hurting them, and it will stay amongst whoever's in that room. How do you create that safe space for people who come to Black space?
First, we make sure to have an environment that is beautiful. Many times with Black and brown folks, it can be a community center in a basement or a small little room or something left over for free. We are not left over. So the space is beautiful. So No Studios generally is a beautiful place. And even if we're not at No Studios, we have to make sure that the space is beautiful, comfortable, chairs are comfortable. I love African and Latina art. So making sure that we have our masks and blankets and things like that, that just make it beautiful. As soon as you come in the door, you're gonna hear music, and you're gonna hear good music, jazz, R&B, and it'll be all inspirational, and it'll all be beatful, B-E-A-T, so that when you come in, you feel comfortable. When you do, Darius and Corey will generally greet you at the door, ask how you're doing. We will have coffee and tea or something warm to drink and maybe something to eat for free. And you can go and get that at whatever facility that's in our location. So as we escort you into the room, the vibe is there. Come on in. Hi, how you doing? We're going to have a discussion about anything you want to talk about. Where are you from? How's it going? You're going to get anything to snack on, whether it be candy or what have you. We have all the PPE precautions. So you're going to have, you know, your Black space mask. If you don't have one yourself, you have something to drink, you have something to write on, you have your clipboard, you have your special notebook to take notes on, you have a self-care sheet that I've developed, if that's, you know, so that you can look on that just to say, oh, okay, at least I have a mood of maybe what's to come. Making sure that everyone knows that everything that goes on here stays here and it is a therapeutic experience. I'm not your therapist. I'm the facilitator of this group, meaning you're going to run this group. I'm just your guide.
A lot of the individuals know Darius and I, and also knows Dr. Knox, but we are coming in there with the sense that there's each and every person coming in there looking to create space for their own story. And there is this verbal Venn diagram that is being displayed as soon as like Dr. Knox is facilitating, because we are sharing like stories. However, each and every individual story is unique, and we're approaching each one as such. So I've not been able to have the experience to be able to sit down with the women or the LGBTQIA plus groups, but I have sat down with the men portion. And those are the ones that I can experience and say for myself, those experiences are very cathartic. It is a poetic speech that each and every individual is speaking. Mark Twain has said it best, that there's a local color or this local regional talk that everyone's having. And it shows very much so in these settings where we're having very generational conversations, from early 90s babies to late 70s and 80s and then even 2000s, where this cross-generational discussion is being analyzed from various viewpoints. And also there's inexperienced and inexperienced individuals that have experience from having anxiety attacks about raising their first child, having anxiety attacks about, hey, how can I show myself in this interview, job interview? How can I show myself to my parents? And there's just this variant conversation that's going on that's very cathartic, because you can see there's this emotional release going on as individuals are talking. There's this emotional release for the people that aren't even saying a word, but taking in everything everyone else is saying and feeling super connected. So that's why I say it was very, very fulfilling seeing that people are walking away, creating these sub-communities for themselves, because we know at the end of the day that these individuals be able to connect with someone that has shared experiences. Mm-hmm. Honestly, that's all it takes to make a community.
So what are y'all's hopes for Black Space? What impact are you looking for?
For the very first year, we're looking to have a set model that we're looking to go with. And then from there, making sure we're connecting with real organizations that cultivate Black and Brown individuals that may or may not have this type of session where it's deeply rooted for Black and Brown individuals to be able to have this, you know, therapeutic experience. Even corporate, having people that are sitting in corporate that are from underserved communities, mm-hmm. meaning specifically that they do not have access to adequate medical care, that they do not have access that reflects the people from their neighborhoods. Underserved does not mean that you're poor. It does not mean that you're a minority or whatever the case may be. Underserved is that you do not have the decent connection to be able to adequate medical care, healthcare resources, and so on and so forth.
I think what Corey said is 100% right. Just everything that we look to do further on. So we definitely want to expand and see how we can help a wide variety of people and not just within the city.
And making sure that we are always, first and foremost, taking care of our community, making sure that they're cared for properly, ethically, and making sure that these group therapy experiences are just opening the doors and giving them that experience so they can then go out and find their therapists.
Dr. Leah Knox, Darius Smith, and Corey Fells are the founding members of Black Space, a free group therapy experience for Black, Brown, and LGBTQ people in Milwaukee. They spoke to WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell in April. If you'd like to attend sessions at Black Space, you can learn more at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the history of the Lake Geneva Playboy Club and the stigma of being a bunny. But first, we'll look at the Prohibition era in Milwaukee and the defiance that came to define that time in the city's history.
It was known as a tavern the day before Prohibition took effect, transitioned into being a soft drink parlor the day after. A lot of the bars that were operating in the city just never closed.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. There's no denying it. Milwaukee is a city that likes to drink. Throughout the city's history, beer making and drinking have been a defining part of Milwaukee culture. But all that changed with the constitutional amendment that outlawed liquor nationwide in 1920. Or at least it should have. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Milwaukeeans didn't take too kindly to the new amendment. And the time period now known as the Prohibition era was marked more by lawlessness and defiance than it was by any kind of sobriety. Matthew Prigge wrote all about it for Milwaukee Magazine, and we spoke about it in June. Something the article gets into that I think some listeners might find surprising is there was a sort of easing into prohibition. It wasn't exactly overnight. As I was reading your piece, I wondered, did that give Milwaukeeans time to prepare for the constitutional ban?
Well, national prohibition actually began in the middle of 1919. And this was, at that time, everybody already knew that the constitutional ban on alcohol was coming at the beginning of 1920. But this action by the federal government, it was supposed to be because of the First World War, which was essentially over by that time. But it was a piece of legislation that had moved real slowly and had finally come into effect, would finally take effect, rather, in June 1919, when, you know, alcohol would be illegal nationwide. And, you know, both this kind of pre-prohibition prohibition and all the run-up to this did give people a lot of time to prepare. Certainly a lot of people who had the money stocked up. There was probably no better heyday for home bars in Milwaukee than in the months leading up to the introduction of prohibition. But there's also this period, you know, that kind of slow introduction, a soft introduction, if you will, left a lot of people thinking that this wouldn't actually happen, that before, you know, the constitutional amendment would take effect, something would be done to counteract this. So in 1919, you know, people did stock up because they knew things were going to be hard to get soon. But there was also this sort of, I don't want to say jovial, but it wasn't taken all that seriously, because I think a lot of people didn't actually think that this would really happen.
At the time, it must have been pretty odd being a Milwaukeean, because even at that point in the city's history, it was pretty inextricably linked to alcohol, and specifically beer. So it doesn't surprise me that there were people who thought, well, something's going to happen. But when it really set in that, yes, alcohol was going to be illegal, that prohibition was really going to be enacted, how did the city respond?
A lot of people didn't change their behaviors all that much. The transition from pre-prohibition to the prohibition period, you know, as far as tavern culture was concerned, really just involved a lot of, you know, shifting definitions of what a tavern was. What was known as a tavern the day before prohibition took effect, transitioned into being a soft drink parlor the day after. A lot of the bars that were operating in the city just never closed, because there was, you know, not only the issue of people maybe not taking this seriously in the long term, there's also the matter of enforcement. A lot of officials in Milwaukee didn't want to have anything to do with enforcing prohibition. Of course, if you have a law, it doesn't really mean anything unless there's someone there to enforce it. So that was left to the Federal Prohibition Authority, which did establish an office in southeastern Wisconsin when prohibition came into effect. But this was a very small office. They were very understaffed at times. So in addition to that attitude that this wasn't something that was going to last, there was also an attitude that people figured out pretty quickly once it did come into effect, that there really wasn't much threat of getting in trouble early on for continuing as they had before.
As you say, people's behavior didn't seem to change that much, except that they came up with these kinds of workarounds. But of course, the city's big industry at the time, a big industry for the city now, beer making, was impacted. How did prohibition affect breweries in the city?
Thousands of jobs were lost in the breweries. And, you know, some jobs were lost elsewhere too. You know, obviously distribution of beer. Some taverns did close. Their business went down. But the breweries themselves found other ways to survive. I don't get on that too much in this article, because I think that's something that's been discussed quite a bit elsewhere. But, you know, if your story is about, you know, Pabst made a processed cheese, for example. Some of the breweries went into making non-alcoholic beer. Some of them, I think one of them, you know, went into making snowblowers or something like that. So they, you know, they were the big businesses. They were not, I don't want to say prepared for this, but they were a little more well-equipped to take the hit than, you know, the local tavern keepers, who, you know, had to, again, pretty much, you know, skirt the law from the beginning to stay afloat.
Well, and although a lot of jobs were lost, it seemed like a lot of people still went to work pretty quickly. Overnight, it seems like people started making their own alcohol in secret. And what's funny about this is, I guess it wasn't as secretive in Milwaukee, but we do have a lot of evidence and indication that this was happening. What was some of the stuff you found that pointed to the fact people were clearly making alcohol?
Well, a lot of I mentioned the brewery workers, a good career path for some of those people, if you had the know-how, was to become basically a private advisor to people who wanted to make beer in the home, because a lot of people tried to do that. And that is indicated by these enormous spikes in the products that go into making beer. They were all of a sudden very hard to find in the city. Malt and hops that were sold here, very high demand. There are actually shops that opened up kind of, you know, with a wink, selling exclusively these things that would go into beer making. And also, you know, other ingredients for example, juniper extract is something that's used in bathtub gin. That was suddenly in very high demand. Even I saw one notice in the newspaper that the public library had all of a sudden lost all of their copies of winemaking books from people either just stealing them or checking them out and never returning them. So yeah, there was that in that, you know, period there, 1919, there was a time when there was still a lot of pre-prohibition alcohol around that people had stocked up on, and that kind of kept everybody satisfied for a while. But then as that supply ran out, actual legitimate, especially hard alcohol, became very hard to find. Beer became very hard to find. So people did have to go into making their own. And especially in the hard liquor, a lot of that was not good stuff. There were cases of people showing up with alcohol poisoning in the first days of prohibition. That was a constant problem throughout this decade.
Yeah, you bring that up in the article that alcohol poisoning was a big problem. And of course, part of that would be that there wasn't regulation of this type of bathtub gin. It was, of course, illegal. So as we look at the waning days of prohibition, something I found interesting was that, you know, federal enforcement didn't really stop until the time and day that the law was enacted. These raids continued.
Getting back to the enforcement thing, later on in the 1920s, the enforcement did become a little more, significantly more effective. And that was because of the thing that was known as the padlock powers, as they called them, that were given to judges. And that basically said that any building or room in which illegal alcohol was being sold, judges had the option to padlock, to close the doors on that place of business for one calendar year. So that, you know, made all of a sudden the renting of speakeasies or secret hotel bars, it made it so that real estate people didn't want to do this anymore, because they knew who they were renting to beforehand, and they didn't have a problem with it. But if they were going to lose access to their property for a year, all of a sudden that wasn't such an attractive option. So that was really the thing that drove down the speakeasy, or brought down the speakeasy era in Milwaukee. But you know, the actual raids that would discover these places, as you said, yeah, continued literally up until the very last hours before the repeal of the 18th Amendment went into effect. You know, it must have been an odd time that they, you know, what had to go and do this to bust up this place, that if they had just waited, you know, one extra day, there would have been no violation there. But they were duty bound, as you might say, so they went about doing their work.
It is hard to imagine Milwaukee as a city without alcohol. So I guess it's not surprising that they continue to drink through it. But it's interesting to see what that time period was like for us.
You know, there was a lot of cultural connections to, especially beer, in Milwaukee with the German population. And the Italian neighborhood in the city at that time, too, was the Third Ward. And that quickly became one of the hot spots for speakeasies. And again, that was, you know, through a tradition of home winemaking and wine being part of that culture. So there were these things that, you know, other than just the the aspect of nightlife and the aspect of getting drunk that I'm sure drew a lot of people to this. But there is also, you know, a cultural thing that kept this going. So it was a lot of people, especially the local officials here who backed away from enforcing any part of this. People in Milwaukee very much felt that they had a right to drink and that this was an assault on that right. And they pretty much treated it as such.
Yeah. Well, Matthew Prigge, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thanks again for having me. It's always a fun time.
Matthew Prigge is a freelance writer and historian. He wrote about the Prohibition era in Milwaukee for Milwaukee Magazine. And you can find a link to the article at wuwm.com. Coming up next, we'll explore the history of Wisconsin's Playboy Club through the book Shoulder Season. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Lake Geneva, Wisconsin has been a tourist destination for more than a century. But for two decades, it was perhaps best known for one specific resort, the Lake Geneva Playboy Club. By the time I was growing up there in the 90s, the club had been closed for about a decade. But its legacy remains a potent part of local lore. Christina Clancy's latest novel, Shoulder Season, digs into the resort's history and gives a personal look at what it was like for the women who worked there. The book is told through the perspective of Sherry, a young woman from nearby East Troy, who's confronted by the preconceptions and expectations of Playboy bunnies. Sherry is, in part, based on the women who Clancy interviewed about their experiences working at Lake Geneva's Playboy Club. She joined me in July to talk about the book. Growing up around Milwaukee, what was your image of the Playboy Resort in Lake Geneva? How did it exist in the popular imagination?
It didn't really exist very much for me. I had heard stories mostly from the guys in my high school of going skiing at the resort and getting served by bunnies, served hot chocolate. And so I'd heard about that, but I really kind of forgot that Playboy actually had a resort in Lake Geneva until I was there for a family reunion at the Grand Geneva. That's what the hotel is called now. And I saw a curio cabinet off to the side of the lobby. And then I remembered, oh yeah, this used to be a Playboy resort. And I loved how people would tell me kind of in a whisper, like, this was a Playboy resort, even though it's been 40 years since it was open.
One of the funny things about the Playboy resort that your book really gets into is the image of the resort. You just mentioned you had high school friends who spent time there and were served hot chocolate by bunnies. I actually spent a lot of my childhood at the Playboy Resort, now known as the Grand Geneva. And it seems going back to even the foundation of the Playboy Resort, it was a family destination. Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I found most surprising when I started interviewing the Playboy bunnies, because I really did originally want to go on the hunt for some salacious, really crazy, you know, bacchanalian stories about the resort. But instead, my interviews with Playboy bunnies revealed that it really wasn't that wild. In fact, it was kind of insanely staid. You know, one of the bunnies told me that she would supervise the game room and teach kids how to play backgammon. Another bunny told me that she would supervise the Easter egg hunt in her Playboy costume. And so for a while, I actually began to panic. I thought, what am I going to write about? You know, there's nothing going on here. But then I found out, you know, the more I talked to people, the more I realized that, like in any job, people can get around some of the rules and have fun outside of the resort. But really, it was a family resort. Families had Sunday brunch there, and they engaged in all the activities that you just described.
Sherry, your main character, likely wouldn't have had the reference for a Frank Lloyd Wright. She was a pretty young woman living in East Troy, a nearby small town. And something that struck me about the book in general is when it's going into the history of these different women, when it's talking about the area in general, you hear a lot of these small towns referenced. When you were talking with the bunnies, were they mostly people from the area to begin with?
Yes, that's something that struck me, is that the women who worked there were generally from area small towns. They did have some people who had come from the cities, and they seemed very different to the women that I talked to. They said they seemed tougher and more in charge. But in general, the bunnies were drawn from the local community, and they were all, I like to describe them as daughters of dairy farmers or factory workers, or maybe their dad was a cop or a slaughterhouse truck driver. They didn't really have a sort of frame of reference for the Playboy lifestyle that Hugh Hefner kind of liked his readers to envision. Instead, they had to try to live up to that while also having this heady experience of working at the resort. So it was really fun to describe what it must have been like for them to be Playboy bunnies, to become something totally different than what they originally had been.
The process of becoming a bunny is notoriously difficult, as Gloria Steinem revealed. And we see that play out in the book in a variety of ways. Can you describe what that experience was like, both for your character in the book, but also the women who you spoke to?
Yeah, well, so Gloria Steinem famously went undercover as a Playboy bunny. And she revealed some of the working conditions that the bunnies had to face, like stuffing dry cleaner bags underneath their bust to make their bust look bigger, and the excruciatingly small costumes that the bunnies wore, and the high heels, and the long hours that they would work. And she actually improved a lot of working conditions for Playboy bunnies in general. However, she also, I think, in a way, while trying to unveil what it was like as a bunny, she also further stigmatized the bunnies. And so many of the bunnies that I talked to were actually, I wouldn't say resentful, that sounds too strong, but I think they didn't necessarily appreciate being thought of the way people were kind of trained to think of Playboy bunnies after reading Gloria Steinem's account. You know, because when you're from a small town, especially in 1981, there really weren't a lot of other options for women where they could make the kind of money that the bunnies could have. And because the resort was right down the street from Alpine Valley Music Amphitheater, it was a really fun place. There are celebrities and rock musicians and stars there. And I could imagine how that would be really appealing for a young woman to want to work there.
And to that point, a lot of your book has to deal with the sociological expectations of women. We see this play out with Sherry in a variety of ways, with her friends from her hometown, with strangers who perhaps don't know what it means to do her work, but also when she's at the Playboy Resort itself, there are all of these different expectations. What was that experience like for bunnies?
Yeah, well, one of the things that struck me is one of the bunnies said that when they were serving customers, they were always told to address the wives first and to be extra nice to the wives who came to the resort. And she said, you don't want them to treat you like the trash they think you are. And that really stood out to me. I thought that must be so hard for them to have to be thought of that way by people and know that they're looking at them that way, while at the same time, men feel perfectly comfortable coming to the resort. And, you know, they're part of their experiences, and what they desire is to be waited on by a beautiful young woman. So it must have been really hard for them to live up to those expectations. And what I found really incredibly moving was when I talked to some of the bunnies who are retired now, who are mostly in their 60s, and they would say that they feel stigmatized still to this day. You know, people would ask me, when I tell them that I was working on a book about the Playboy Resort, they'd say, well, weren't they prostitutes or exotic dancers? And my experience was it wasn't that at all. And I could understand why some of the bunnies I talked to didn't want people to know that they were bunnies. And the other thing that was interesting is a lot of the bunnies that I knew only worked there for a summer, yet they're a bunny for life. You know, once you're a bunny, it's something that kind of overwhelms your personality even all these years later. So it was fascinating to think about what women are subjected to. And then I also thought about what it must have been like for them to work as bunnies and then come back to their small towns. That's something I wanted to explore in the book when I had Sherry Taylor return home and she may or may not have been stigmatized at home the way she thought that she was going to be. And maybe her behavior would change if she maybe realized people didn't look down on her the way that she thought they did. Or maybe they did. I'd like to leave it to the reader to come to their own conclusions.
Sure. Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I really love talking to you about the book.
Christina Clancy is the author of Shoulder Season, a novel about the Lake Geneva Playboy Club and the Playboy Bunnies. We spoke earlier this year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week, with help from Chase Browning, Kobe Brown, and Valeria Navarro-Villegas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. This week, we also heard from Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, and Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you missed any of the conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. And thank you for listening to Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.